film crew and several foreign journalists, including Thierry de Jordan from Le Figaro, were setting up their equipment. I approached the Shah, greeted him. The Shah was standing there and staring at some vague outside. He asked, "How are you, Mr. Naragi?" I replied, "I'm fine. Thank you, Your Majesty." I then asked, "Is it true that Your Majesty plans to leave the country?" The Shah, as if he was being forced, said, "Bakhtiar requested this." Surprised, I asked, "Your Majesty, you appointed Bakhtiar yourself. How could he impose this condition on you?" Indifferently, he replied, "It's not just Bakhtiar. Others want this too. They say if I don't leave and Khomeini doesn't return, the crisis will continue." He then turned to the journalists and said to me, "I have an appointment now, Mr. Naragi. Stay here until my interview is over. I want to hear what you have to say." I nodded in obedience, and the Shah sat down in front of the cameras.
En effet, c'est un problème ou bien même un souci qui nous préoccupe.
The Shah's strange behavior puzzled me. He was leaving the country, knowing he wouldn't return. Yet he sat in front of the foreigners, talking about the future he wanted to build for Iran. Like the tragic figure from history, Don Quixote, he exhibited a dual behavior. He was on the brink of collapse, but posed as a hero. Mohammad Reza's history in this matter is so remarkable that 10 books could be written about it. Throughout those years, whenever the slightest incident occurred, he decided to leave the country, as if he wasn't the Shah. The history of this matter is both fascinating and bitter.
Tehran, September 1941. During World War II, despite Reza Shah giving the Allies whatever concessions they demanded, the British still decided to remove him from the throne. The British instructed Prime Minister Furughi, whom they supported, to force Reza Shah to abdicate, but they also opposed the young Crown Prince becoming Shah. They argued that Mohammad Reza, due to his temperament, weakness, and fear, would side with the Germans. However, Furughi managed to convince the British, and the 22-year-old Mohammad Reza took his father's place on the throne. Reza Shah was exiled to the island of Mauritius. During his youth, Mohammad Reza studied in Europe and became enamored with Western customs and lifestyle. Consequently, from the very beginning of his reign, he often told his associates that ruling a country with such poor people was not an honor for him. Whenever he felt he needed to confront the people, the clergy, or intellectuals to maintain his throne, he preferred to abandon the country and return to Europe. Many people close to the royal family witnessed his indifference to the throne and being a Shah multiple times. The first time when Mohammad Reza wanted to leave the country was when the Allies opposed his ascension to the throne. With complete frankness and without any tension, Mohammad Reza had told Farouki, "If they do not want me to be the Shah, then it is better that I leave Iran." However, Farouki, using all of his tricks, managed to dissuade him. According to Abbas Qoli Golshayan, who was the finance minister at the time, the day Reza Shah was forced by the British to leave Iran, the crown prince was in a hurry to leave the country before him and was quite eager to do so. Tehran, December 1942. A year later, the Shah once again decided to abandon the country and leave Iran. During those years, the presence of the Allies in Iran had led to famine. Bread and provisions were scarce, and people took to the streets. Before martial law was declared, the Shah had already packed his bags. The military governor of Tehran promised to restore order. General Amir Ahmadi kept his promise. He brought tanks and machine guns to the streets and opened fire on the people. The Shah then changed his mind about leaving. Tehran, April 1945. Towards the end of Zahedi's premiership, the economic situation worsened by the day. Government employees had not been paid for months. Strikes began, and the country was in turmoil. During this time, the Shah intended to leave the country for the third time. Hossein Ala, who was a minister, tried to change his mind. The Shah dismissed Zahedi and appointed Ala as prime minister. Mohammad Reza gave a three-month deadline for the situation to improve, otherwise he would leave Iran permanently. The Pahlavi family and his close associates constantly urge Ala to keep the Shah from becoming disheartened, as if Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was not the Shah of a great country, but a pampered and impatient prince with no responsibilities. Tehran, December 1947. In the autumn of that year, Qawam al-Sultaneh, who had become prime minister for the fourth time, went to meet Stalin in Moscow. Unlike previous occasions when Qawam had made concessions to the Americans. This time, he had gotten very close to the Russians and had heavily involved the Tudeh party in his plans. He did not keep the Shah well informed about his actions. Mohammad Reza, upset by Qavam's behavior, wanted to abdicate and leave Iran. According to Ashraf Pahlavi, the Shah even suggested to his brother Abdul Reza that he should take his place. However, severe disagreements between the parliament and Qavam led to the fall of his government, and Mohammad Reza's abdication was averted. This was the fourth time the Shah had intended to leave the country. Tehran, March of 1953. When Mossadegh became prime minister, Mohammad Reza's problems increased by the day. Oil had become nationalized and the economic situation of the people had improved. This increased Mossadegh's popularity. He almost ignored Mohammad Reza, and his government's behavior made the Shah of Iran appear humiliated and insignificant among the people. This greatly troubled Mohammad Reza, but instead of finding a solution, he decided to plot Mossadegh's assassination with the help of his sister. The plot was uncovered, the prime minister was saved, and the disgraced Shah decided to leave Iran. This time, the British ambassador intervened and promised to resolve the Mossadegh issue soon. This was the fifth time that Mohammad Reza decided to leave Iran during his 12-year reign.
With you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
After sentencing in felony hush money case, Donald Trump can still vote but can't own a gun and will have to turn over a DNA sample to New York State's crime data bank. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Appearing in court virtually from his Mar-a-Lago home on Friday, 10th of January, President-elect Donald Trump was sentenced for his crimes in the New York hush money case and released with no restrictions. Justice Juan Merchant followed through on a promise made 1 week ago to give Donald Trump a sentence of unconditional discharge, which includes neither jail time nor any other restriction that might impede Trump after his inauguration on 20th of January. Judge Juan Merchan said during the sentencing on Friday 10th of January that he was granting that sentence because he believes it was the only legal option just 10 days before Donald Trump assumes the presidency. Judge Juan Merchan told the court that this has been a truly extraordinary case, even though once the courtroom doors closed, the trial itself had been, in his estimation, no more special or unique than any other trial. However, he told Donald Trump, the same could not be said about the circumstances surrounding the president-elect's sentencing because of the office you once occupied and will soon occupy again. Judge Juan Merchan said that it was the legal protections afforded to the office of the president that were extraordinary, not the occupant of the office. Those legal protections were a factor that overrode all others. But they were not a mitigating factor. The judge said they did not reduce the seriousness of the crimes or erase the jury's verdict. Judge Juan Merchan said he determined that the only lawful sentence he could give without encouraging on the highest post in the land was an unconditional discharge. Donald Trump, the civilian, he said, might not have gotten so lenient a sentence. In the courtroom, Donald Trump and attorney Todd Blanche, who has also been tapped by the president-elect to serve as the deputy attorney general, could be seen via video feed sitting next to each other, with two American flags visible behind them in a room with dark wooden walls. Trump was given the opportunity to address the court. He called the trial a very terrible experience and a tremendous setback for New York. With all the horrible things that are going on, I got indicted for calling a legal expense, Trump said, referring to the falsified reimbursements to a former lawyer for a hush money payment at the core of the trial. Donald Trump added, "It's been a political witch hunt. It was done to damage my reputation so that I'd lose the election, and obviously that didn't work." Trump added, "The fact is, I'm totally innocent. I did nothing wrong." Ahead of sentencing, prosecutor Joshua Steinglass said Trump's actions on attacking the judicial system and prosecutors in this case constitutes a direct attack on the rule of law itself. Far from expressing any kind of remorse for his criminal conduct, the defendant has purposefully bred disdain for our judicial institutions and the rule of law, and he's done this to serve his own ends and to encourage others to reject the jury verdict that he finds so distasteful, Steinglass reiterated. Steinglass added, "Put simply, this defendant has caused enduring damage to public perception of the criminal justice system and has placed officers of the court in harm's way." Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg was in attendance in the courtroom in the gallery, but did not address the court. Associated Press has also covered the same story. President-elect Donald Trump doesn't have to go to jail, pay a fine, or perform community service as a result of his New York hush money conviction. A judge ended the case on Friday, 10th of January, with a sentence of an unconditional discharge, closing the case with no punishment. But unless the conviction for falsifying business records is someday overturned, Donald Trump will have felonies on his criminal record, which will affect some of his rights. Here are some of the potential impacts and some things that won't change. Trump is registered to vote in Florida, and he will be able to vote in Florida. Florida bars people convicted of felonies from voting, but restores their right to vote after they have completed their sentence. People convicted of murder or a sex offense lose their right to vote permanently unless their rights are restored by a clemency board. For people convicted of felonies in other states, like Donald Trump, Florida only makes a person ineligible to vote if they lost their voting rights in the state where they were convicted. New York State doesn't let a person convicted of a felony vote while they're incarcerated, but restores voting rights once that person is released. Can Donald Trump own a gun? The answer is no. Under federal law, people convicted of felonies are not allowed to possess firearms. Does Donald Trump have to give a DNA sample? By law, every person convicted of a felony in New York State must provide a DNA sample for the state's crime data bank. Samples are collected after sentencing, typically when a defendant reports to probation, jail, or prison. Samples can also be taken by a court or police official. It is a non-invasive process involving a swab along the inside of the cheek. State police analyze the cells and genetic material, creating a profile that is then entered into the data bank. There, technology takes over, performing automatic searches and comparing profiles of people convicted of crimes with profiles of DNA collected at crime scenes. Matches can be used to identify a suspect in an unsolved crime. New York's data bank contains profiles of more than 720,000 offenders and is connected to the FBI's combined DNA index system. But can Donald Trump hold office with a felony conviction? There is nothing in federal law that prevents a person from becoming president because they have been convicted of a crime. State laws vary on whether a person with a criminal record can run for state and local offices. Some require a pardon or expungement to run for office. There are no such limits to run for federal office. Can Donald Trump travel outside of the United States? Yes. As president, Donald Trump will have a diplomatic passport enabling him to travel to foreign countries for official business and can also keep a regular or tourist passport as well. Some countries restrict or reserve the right to prohibit visits from people with felony convictions, including Canada and the United Kingdom. Can Donald Trump get a pardon? Only New York Governor Kathy Hochul has the power to pardon Donald Trump for this conviction. Trump's case was tried in state court and involved violations of New York state law. Presidential pardons only apply to federal crimes. It seems unlikely that New York Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat, would pardon Donald Trump. Asked last month if she would consider pardoning Trump, Hochul didn't say yes or no, but noted that the pardon process requires several elements, including the element of remorse. Trump says he did nothing wrong and has described the case against him as a hoax perpetrated by the Democrats.
Hidden files. We have now been witnessing horrific scenes coming out of Gaza as we have watched the Israeli genocide continue there. As we know, the problem Palestinians have with Zionists did not start on October the 7th. But why is it that many people in the world are just finding out about this story? And now that they have found out, what could it mean? Well, stay with us as we take a look at this and more on this Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi, and welcome to the show. Today, we're going to talk to an American journalist who was just as misinformed as most Americans, but then did research on the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and what she discovered would change her life, but also change the life of many others forever.
Here is an American activist and writer known for her interest in the topic of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. She's the founder and executive director of the nonprofit organization If Americans Knew, president of the Council for the National Interest, and author of Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel.
I'd like to welcome journalist Allison Ware to the program. Allison, thank you so much for being with us here on Hidden Files. What would you say, as an American journalist and editor of a small town weekly in Sausalita, turn your attention to the issue of Israel and Palestine to begin with?
As you say, I was just the editor of a very small newspaper, so I was not covering international news at all. But in the fall of 2000, when my youngest son had left home for the university, and I had a little more time just to be curious about things, the Second Intifada was in the news in the U.S. So I was seeing these images of sometimes children throwing stones against tanks. And, I decided for the first time in my life to pay attention to the issue of Israel-Palestine. You know, for most Americans, that seems very far away, confusing if you're not Jewish. You don't feel it has any real connection to you. But in this case, I was curious, so I looked into I decided to follow the news coverage. And when I did that, I noticed that it seemed very one-sided. As a journalist, as you know, you're supposed to look into the full story and hear from different people. And I noticed that we were hearing from and about Israelis in great detail, as I wanted. But then I thought and expected that I would hear from and about Palestinians also, since there are two parties in that conflict. And I noticed that came much less frequently. So I felt I was really getting one side of an important story. Google and the internet was pretty new back then, but I realized that was a resource I could try to use to learn more about what was going on. And I started to do some internet searches, which was brand new. And I discovered that there were news sources in the region itself that were giving information day by day, sometimes hour by hour. So after work, I would start looking into those. And I learned that unarmed Palestinians, were being killed every day in large numbers, many of them children. This was covered in considerable detail. I also learned that the U.S. was at that time giving Israel $8 million per day. I'd never known that, and I think almost nobody knew that. It was never mentioned in U.S. news coverage. So I saw that there were really atrocities and human rights violations going on every day using my tax money, and yet it was not being covered in the American media. So it seemed to me this was the biggest cover-up I had ever seen.
Well, Allison, tell me about your trip to Palestine. I think that trip changed your professional life.
That changed the course of my life. Yes, after a few months of doing that, I began to think this was so important. I needed to go and see for myself what was going on. So in February and March of 2001, before the 9/11 attack, many months before the attacks on the World Trade Center, I traveled over to Gaza and the West Bank as a freelance journalist. I traveled around by myself. This was before the ISM movement. So I was there just as a journalist with my notebook and small camera. And I saw firsthand what was going on. I saw firsthand small children who'd been shot. I was in the home of a family whose little son had just been killed by Israeli forces. I went to neighborhoods in Gaza that were already bullet riddled. You know, they. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking it seemed like pictures I had seen of World War II, with massive destruction in some of those neighborhoods.
And this was you said 2001.
That's right, early 2001. So this is long. No Palestinian rockets had been fired yet. Hamas was not in charge yet. That was many years in the future. And it was already, there were already these major attacks on Palestinians, both in, also in the West Bank and in Gaza. Children being shot, people being shot, homes being destroyed, shelling of entire neighborhoods, both in Gaza and in the West Bank. So I saw that and experienced firsthand. And when I came back to the United States, I decided to start an organization that would be non-ideological. It would be to reach every American across the political spectrum of every religion and ethnicity. And I named it If Americans Knew, because I felt if other Americans knew what I at that time knew, we would have very different U.S. policies.
Allison, what do you think is the most important aspect of U.S. and Israeli relationships that if Americans knew, it would make a difference?
There are a number of things. One of the main things to start with is that we are giving Israel massive amounts of money. So therefore, we're responsible for what Israel does. And it gives us a connection. Many people, as you know, are busy raising children, working jobs, trying to keep things together. There are many important issues around the world and in the United States. So when this just seemed like a far away, distant, confusing issue, most people don't pay enough attention to it. But when they realize, wait, we give more of our tax money to this tiny country than anywhere else, I better pay attention. So I think it's first learning that they have a very significant connection to it. And then when they learn what's going on, there's the human reality of seeing the tragedy that's being done to Palestinians that began, you know, over 75 years ago. It's not new. And beginning to learn the history of it, they know about every issue from the American media, yes, often from broadcast media, you know, radio and TV. And so the key is what's the information there? And much of it's being covered up. Much of it's just not there. When they do learn about Gaza, some of the reports barely mention the facts of what's actually going on. There'll be a few seconds maybe, and then they'll focus on the Israeli hostages and make them humanize their families, and never hear about the, you know, many thousands of Palestinian prisoners that are held without trial, without charge, often physically abused, psychologically abused. So the problem is that most people try to pay attention to the news on this issue are often getting very incomplete news, sometimes really fallacious news.
I mean, what would you say the effect on people watching this ongoing genocide take place in real time?
I think many of us, it's just excruciating. I think many people around the world and, you know, many of us just find it horrific to watch day after day after day. Hundreds more people being killed every day, many of them, most of them women and children, and just going on day after day after day. The thing that's different about this genocide than many in the past is that we are seeing it. Those of us that know where to look, that follow Al Jazeera and Press TV and other places, are learning these facts every day. And it's astounding to me that it can continue without the world stopping it, that it continues day after day without people stopping it. And then I realize when I go around, you know, my small town and areas that many people have no idea this is, you know, many of us are following it and seeing it every hour. There are other people that live near us and, you know, within our geographic area who aren't even aware of what's being done to children.
I mean, so you're saying in the middle of this genocide that there's still many people that don't even know about it?
I think many don't. I've been trying recently to watch. I record the news broadcasts, but I haven't had time to be watching them very much. And I just watched what Fox TV has been having. And, you know, I saw that recently they did show briefly images of Gaza, and they did have a brief interview, you know, with, not an interview, but someone, I think it was UNICEF or a humanitarian agency, mentioning about what was going on, but it was just on screen for a few seconds. And this was in the context of Hamas being depicted as terrorists, that Gazans are, you know, that anything that's happening in Gaza is the fault of Hamas, that it's really Israel that's suffering. There was a report about the Houthi attacks on shipping without any explanation about why they were doing it, why this was, you know, perceived by many people as a very understandable action, given that there's a genocide going on, and everybody in the world has an obligation to try to stop it, try to get the world to stop it. But that didn't come through in the news coverage.
Well, viewers, stay with us. We're going to continue our discussion with Allison Weir right after this short break. Stay with us.
Who owns U.S. media? Six media companies control 90% of U.S. media. Four out of those six companies are Time Warner, Comcast, Disney, and News Corp. Asset management firms own large shares in companies that sell weapons of war, and they also own large shares of mainstream media organizations. BlackRock, Inc. and the Vanguard Group, Inc. hold large shares in the world's largest arm-producing company, Lockheed Martin Corp., as well as Raytheon, and the group also partial owns mainstream news media organizations. NBC is owned by Comcast. Comcast is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. ABC is owned by Disney, and Disney is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. Times is owned by Time Warner, and Time Warner is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. CBS is owned by Viacom CBS, which is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. Fox News is owned by News Corp, which is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. As the genocide in Gaza continues, it is not likely that Americans will be able to get the true story of what is happening. This is as long as their media is owned by corporations, and several of those corporations are parts of the military-industrial complex. A conflict of interest, to say the least.
Well, thanks so much for staying with us. Allison, I'd like to continue with looking at the journalist side of everything happening in Gaza. Basically, no one is safe, and so many journalists have been killed in record numbers, and yet we really don't hear the condemnation from mainstream journalists that we should be. Why is that the case?
Yeah, there are some groups, some international groups are making strong statements, but most people don't hear about those. I find that especially, you know, as I say, just the last day or two, I've been focusing on Fox, so I know the other media are also bad, but right now I'm really, really most aware of the Fox coverage. And truthfully, I've thought this is an intentional obstruction of people learning the facts. To me, it's not the journalists that are doing it. They're mouthpieces. I think it's shameful. But what's going on is clearly somebody at the top has decreed that they are not there to give as little information as possible to the American public. I don't think this is just mistakes. As you know, with daily news coverage, mistakes can be made if, you know, operating on a, you know, fairly urgent time scale to try to get the news out. So I don't object when people make a mistake or get things, you know, in a day or two. But the kind of pattern that is becoming apparent as I look at these past broadcasts is that this is an intentional editorial policy that's being made by someone at the top, and it's being carried out by their news directors down below. There's no doubt that that's going on. What I've often focused on the Israel lobby in the United States, because most people are not very aware of that, and there's a real effort to cover up that aspect. Even people that will talk about the human rights violations and the violence often try to cover up the fact that there's a very powerful, very pervasive pro-Israel lobby in the United States that operates in every state. It's certainly very, very very influential in Washington, D.C., in the media, on campuses, that plays an important role in this.
I mean, you just talked about the Israeli lobby, and it's absolutely amazing the amount of money that is spent by the Israeli lobby and basically buying American politicians. And still, many Americans don't realize the connection between the politicians and the Israeli lobby.
That's right, and the financial connection is enormous. You know, already it ranges from about $4 to $5 billion per year, which works out to over $10 million per day. But then on top of this, at the end of 2023, There was an effort by Biden and by Congress to give Israel an additional $14 billion.
I mean, do you think that the genocide will have an effect on redefining international law as we are watching this total failure of the so-called international rules-based system?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure. Certainly, the what's going on at the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, will be very interesting to see what results from that. The presentations there on behalf of South Africa of documenting that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian population were very articulate, extremely compelling, powerful, persuasive. Of course, most Americans didn't see them. I'm waiting to see what happens, like the rest of the world. Will they find the appropriate finding for the court? Or will the governments, because I'm afraid of the power of the United States government, which basically does, as we're seeing with Biden, what Israel tells the U.S. to do, and then therefore the U.S. pressures other governments. Will that make a difference, or will justice actually be served in this case? I think it's an important thing to watch and see what happens. So far, the world has failed. There's no doubt that so far the world has failed to do what should be done, which was to stop the massacres that are going on every day and the other abuses. The U.S. has enabled it. Biden has sent our weapons over there to perpetuate it, more money. The Arab nations, sadly, are not using their power to stop Israel. The European nations are failing to use their power to stop Israel. So, the population around the world, I think, is trying very hard. There are these massive marches. Many people are writing articles and trying to document what's going on. And so there's major effort by people around the world to stop the atrocities, but the powerful and the governments of the world are failing to use their power to stop this. I don't know when or if that will change.
But you just mentioned about the people taking to the streets to protest against this genocide, but do you think that it's also causing an awakening in them about their own governments who are not listening to them and continuing to support the genocide?
I think it certainly is a transitional moment for many people. We saw a comment on one of our Instagram posts today, someone saying, I'm completely ashamed. I had no awareness of this before. But the comment said, now, like millions of people, I'm catching up and I'm learning about it. So I think for many people, it's an aha moment. Like, how did I not know about this? How did I, I thought I cared about human rights. And I didn't even know about this ongoing human rights that started long before the last few months. So I think for many individuals, I think I believe there's a movement going on in the U.S. that I think it's still going on among the Muslim Americans. Some of the organizations that have supported Biden, thinking he would be better than Trump, and have seen that he's not. So there's a movement to use the vote and say, abandon Biden. To not vote for somebody because he's supposedly the lesser of two evils, but to show that that people will no longer vote for somebody who continues to fund genocide. I think would be a major movement if more people do that. And if candidates realize that they will lose the election because they're doing the wrong thing, they're pleasing their campaign donors, they're pleasing the billionaires that fund their campaigns. But if they say that doesn't work, the voters will still vote against them and they'll lose the election. That could have a major impact. It has in the past. In my long life, I've seen major changes in the United States, in some of our domestic policies, and in the Vietnam War being ended, apartheid in South Africa ending. So I've never seen a genocide of this proportion, I don't think. At least I've never seen something, this ongoing massacres day after day after day, funded by my tax money. I don't think I've seen something this bad before, but I have seen other things that were very bad that have been stopped, that the world has sometimes stopped. So I still have hope, I have to have hope that we will somehow, all the work that all of us are doing in journalism and activism and academia on campuses, in churches and mosques, that all of that eventually will counter the power of the elites that seem to want this to continue.
What do you think is the responsibility of your fellow journalists at this time in covering this genocide and the overall Palestinian story?
I think the obligation is the obligation that we always have, which is tell the real facts, find the real facts, and tell them. Don't water it down. Don't give it spin. Don't leave things out because they're too graphic. I think the obligation is to tell people what's going on, the real life, what's happening to human beings in Gaza and in the West Bank. That it's our obligation to tell the facts, whether or not our governments want us to, whether or not we will, you know, many of us have paid a personal cost for doing this. But that's one of the things we have to do. It's important for everyone to do that.
But you've just talked about the personal cost, Allison, and I know you've paid a price for choosing the reality of the Palestinian story and talking about it all these years. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I have. You know, it's very small, of course, compared to what people in the Middle East are feeling, but so it's a small personal cost. But, you know, I'm called names. I've been called anti-Semitic. People imply that I'm a bigot. They don't imply it. They say that. Even though I have a life history of opposing all bigotry, I've been called a communist or a white supremacist. My children have sometimes, it's been uncomfortable for them because then people hear things about their mother that are untrue. I've had death threats. I think that's what happens to anybody and everybody that works on this issue. But fortunately, I've also received some awards for my work and some people have praised it. So I've had negative things, but I've also had positive things. And most of all, I know that I'm doing something that I have to do. So at least I can feel about myself that I'm doing the right thing. And I think that's more important than any of the negatives I've had.
Well, do you have any final words about this continuing genocide and just the overall situation? Final words.
I think it's just appalling that it continues day after day and that we haven't stopped it. It will have major repercussions on the world. I think it could grow into a regional war. There are indications that Israel would like that because that it would give them the chance to do even more of an ethnic cleansing than they're doing now. So bad as it is now, I'm afraid it could end up, it's already involving Yemen.
Thank you so much for being with us, Allison, on Hidden Files. Well, all of us must ask ourselves, what is our responsibility during this crisis, no matter where one is and what he or she does? He or she can do something. It could be as simple as explaining what is going on in Gaza to a friend. From east to west, we've seen people taking to the streets to protest this genocide. Politicians may not show a reaction to these protests in public, but for sure it is making a difference. The pressure must be continued, and journalists all over the world must do their best to explain the real story of Palestine to help in this genocide, occupation, and siege on the Palestinian nation. I'm Marzia Hashemi for Hidden Files, and thanking you for being with us on another program. Goodbye.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
Social media censorship is a global phenomenon, but the war on pro-Palestinian views on social media represents a different kind of censorship, with consequences that can only be described as dire. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, while the international community is yet to translate its verbal solidarity with Palestinians into any meaningful action, the least we could do is to give Palestinians their full rights to express their views. Social media censorship is a global phenomenon, but the war on pro-Palestinian views on social media represents a different kind of censorship, with consequences that can only be described as dire. Long before the current devastating war on Gaza and the escalation of Israeli violence and repression in the occupied West Bank, Palestinian and pro-Palestinian voices have been censored. Some date censorship to an arrangement in 2016 that, according to the Zionist regime government, sought to force social networks to remove content that Israel considers to be incitement. This was translated almost immediately to the shutting down of thousands of accounts and the barring of many social media influencers, with the hope of slowing down the vastly growing pro-Palestinian tendencies in all meta-linked platforms. The war on Gaza, however, has escalated the censorship. In a report submitted to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression, Human Rights Watch noted that the documented restrictions on freedom of speech undermine the fundamental human rights to freedom of expression and assembly. The censorship became so sophisticated and increasingly involved a direct Israeli role. An investigation by The Intercept last October demonstrated that Jordan Kotler, a former senior Israeli regime official now working as Meta's Israel policy chief, advocated for the censorship of Instagram accounts belonging to Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP. To ensure that offenders to the Israeli regime's sensibilities were eliminated in large numbers, Meta began censoring specific words, thus deeming entire contents offensive, racist, and anti-Semitic. But Meta was not the only social media network involved in this practice. On November 17, 2023, the X platform, previously known as Twitter, declared that users who write terms like decolonization from the river to the sea or similar expressions would be suspended. 1 year later, the social media platform Twitch followed suit by revising its hateful content policy to include Zionists as a potential slur. Not only do these decisions and many others directly impair the freedom of speech and press, but they also confuse rational conversations with anti-Jewish sentiments. The word genocide, for example, is not a swear word, but a common term embraced by numerous countries around the world. Accusing the Zionist regime of carrying out acts of genocide, meaning the systematic destruction of a group of people because of their ethnicity, nationality, religion, or race. Under pressure from many countries, and after presenting a powerful case at The Hague, South Africa managed to compel the International Court of Justice accusing the Zionist regime of committing acts of genocide in the Gaza Strip in violation of the 1948 Genocide Convention. In other words, this is not a matter for Mark Zuckerberg or any other social media company to decide, based on direct consultations with those carrying out the mass killings in Gaza. The same applies to Zionism, an ideologically situated political movement that traces its history to 19th century Europe, thus neither to a specific race or a religious text. While many are rightly outraged by the fact that this kind of widespread and growing censorship directly challenges the main tenets of democracy, the actual harm for Palestinians is much bigger. According to a November 2024 report by the Sana Social Center for Digital Rights, the surge in digital violations targeting Palestinian content could not come at a worse time. According to the organization, the Meta platforms accounted for the largest share of violations at 57%, followed by TikTok at 23%. YouTube and X follow at 13% and 7% respectively. This censorship, according to Sada, includes the shutting down of WhatsApp accounts, another Meta-owned platform that is also tightly controlled. Unlike most of us, Palestinians in Gaza use these platforms to communicate with one another, to know who is dead and who is alive, and to raise awareness of certain massacres, often taking place in isolation, especially in northern Gaza Strip. Regarding northern Gaza, Sada Social spoke of a digital blackout which has compounded the horror of that region, including famine, mass killings, destruction of all hospitals, etc. In the specific case of social media censorship in Gaza, lives are literally being lost as a result of politically motivated decisions. Human Rights Watch was one of many rights groups that have routinely spoken about the systematic censorship by Meta, especially on Facebook and Instagram. A December 2023 HRW report identified the following six recurring patterns of censorship. Removal of content. Suspension of for Palestinian accounts, the reduction of visibility known as shadow banning, the restriction on engagement and the deliberate misuse of policies on hate speech and graphic content. HRW said that Meta's over-reliance on automated tools to moderate content and undo government influence over content removals exacerbates the issue, silencing crucial narratives at a time when Palestinian communities face severe repression and atrocities. The danger of this kind of censorship is multi-layered. It is a direct threat to one of the most basic freedoms guaranteed under the law in any democratic society. In the case of Gaza, the censorship takes a dark, deadly turn, as it could make the difference between people dying under the rubble of their homes or receiving assistance. Additionally, censorship of this magnitude often creates precedents and often leads to other forms of censorship, which in fact are already taking place against other vulnerable communities, whether on a national stage or globally. While the international community is yet to translate its verbal solidarity with Palestinians into any meaningful action, the least we could do is to give Palestinians their full rights to express their views, share their pain, and raise awareness of their collective plight. The world owes them that much, and no social media company should be permitted to hinder such a simple and reasonable demand.